This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Photojournalist Tim Hetherington wants to bring the war in Afghanistan home to you. Tim went to one of the most dangerous outposts in Afghanistan, and he followed 15 young men as they fought together in the Korangal Valley. Tim was lucky enough to live through an injury that he sustained. He returned to make a documentary called Restrepo. The film is named for the platoon medic named Juan Doc Restrepo. He died before the main events of the film, but his presence hung over the troops like a shadow. He had the kind of powerhouse personality you can't forget. Here he is mugging for the camera just 1 week before deployment to Afghanistan.
You can't tame the beast. Please tell him, how do we roll? Got him. Got him. Tune in next time where we're going to be still loving life and getting ready to go to war.
What? All right, war? Baby. Afghanistan, what?
Say it again, baby. Say it again.
I didn't even sign my passport.
Baby.
I didn't even sign my passport.
We're going to war. We're going to war. We're going to war.
And go to war they did. The film, based on their experience, won the Grand Jury Prize for Documentary at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's called Restrepo. It's showing tonight at 7 o'clock at the Griffith Theater in the Bryan Center of Duke University. Right now, Tim Hetherington is here in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
How did you decide that this was the film that you wanted to make a film about the Afghan War and make it from the sort of the ground level?
Well, I made the film with my co-director, Sebastian Junger. Sebastian had been covering the Afghan conflict, the Afghan civil war, since the mid-90s. I had been there in 2001. I was in the north, across the border from Tajikistan, when the Taliban were facing off with the Northern Alliance. He was in Kabul. And, you know, we later teamed up together. We went first to the Korangal Valley on assignment for Vanity Fair. And Sebastian had met Battle Company, the 173rd Airborne, in Zabul province in 2005. And he'd realized that America was going to be in Afghanistan for a long time. And he wanted to follow one platoon for a year to get the experience of what a U.S. combat infantryman's life was like. And so that's why we went to the Korangal. We went there to team up with Battle Company again. And we linked up a second platoon. We got to the valley. It was 2007 when the world was firmly focused on Iraq, not realizing the Afghan war had slipped out of control, something we now know to be true. And we got to this valley where over a fifth of all fighting was taking place in the whole of the country. And we said to the Captain Kearney, who was in charge of Battle Company, we said, who's taking the brunt of the fighting? And he pointed down the valley and he said, second platoon's up there. And that's where we went. And that's where Outpost Restrepo was.
Outpost Restrepo, named for Doc Restrepo, who really didn't make it that far. He didn't get to see that outpost built. Tell us a little bit about him.
Juan Restrepo is a Colombian-born individual who was naturalized into the U.S., lived in Pembroke Pines in Florida, and died on the side of a mountain in Afghanistan, which is interesting when you consider the whole immigration debate going on.
Right. He fought and died and was real, kind of heart and soul. You can tell there was that little clip that we played just a bit from. It's right in the beginning of your film. We don't see him for the rest of the film, but we feel his presence all the way through.
Yeah, the film isn't really about Juan and who he is as a character. And, we called the film Restrepo for a number of different reasons. It's after, obviously, Juan, who dies early on in the film. And then the men build an outpost. They name it after him. But we also felt that the name Restrepo could somehow become emblematic or a metaphor for every soldier and the sense of loss that every soldier goes through.
And the kind of bond that soldiers feel.
Absolutely.
The fact that they carry the fallen soldiers into every battle and then home.
Well, we're kind of giving it the name also, this idea that it's the Restrepo generation for all the young men and women that have fought over the last 10 years in these wars.
So in the film, we talk about the soldiers talk about building this outpost. Maybe before we get to this, I want you to describe for me the logic behind this. They're at the boundary of enemy territory, and now they decide to build this outpost just 1 foot beyond, in a sense. A kind of provocation and a statement. Tell us about the decision to build Restrepo.
Well, you know, military tactics are such that you try to take the high ground. If you're in a valley with a base on the valley floor, you're going to get shot up from positions above you. And so a bit like a game of chess, you put outposts out in strategic places to protect. The mothership, so to speak, was the main outpost on the valley floor. And Restrepo was placed on a particular peak where there was a lot of insurgent fire coming from that place. And they went up there and they built an outpost. And it changed the dynamic in the valley.
Here's a description of the construction of Outpost Restrepo.
We walked up the spur with shovels and picks. We worked all through the night just to make a small semicircle to chill in. We slept for maybe a couple hours each, started doing it again. That day we got in 5-7 firefights. We'd dig, they'd shoot at us, they'd see us digging, building this new place, they'd shoot, we'd shoot back. Once it lulled down, we started digging again.
So a scene from the documentary Restrepo. The documentary filmmaker Tim Hetherington is my guest today. It shows tonight at 7 o'clock at Duke. What was it like for you to be in that environment?
Well, it wasn't my first time that I've covered a conflict. You know, I've been reporting from conflict zones for 10 years or more. But every war has its own dynamic. This is my first time embedded with U.S. soldiers. And we really wanted to make the film from the experience of the soldiers. You know, we felt that was the shortest link, as it were, to the American public. And we were worried and concerned about what's happening in Afghanistan. And so obviously when I went there, you know, it was my first time embedding for such a long period of time. This wasn't the kind of usual reporters 2 to 3 weeks. We spent a total of 10 months out there, 5 months each, sometimes together but often apart. And when we got into Outpost Restrepo, it's a small, very, very small place on the side of a mountain, open air, no running water, no electricity, no hot food, no showers, you know, really rudimentary. And it was filmmaking reporting on at an extreme.
It was, and I think you managed to get at what that experience was like. And for the viewer, you will feel it in a way that few other documentaries have done. And of course, because we haven't been allowed to see this war, and we haven't been allowed to see the war in Iraq, this is one of the few ways we get any sense of what's really going on there, apart from the official reports.
Well, one of the strategies we used when we made the film was, you know, we wanted to make the most visceral and immersive war film we could. You know, we looked around. There was a lot of, you know, political opinion pieces in the press. There's, you know, network news pieces where often the journalist is the center of the report on network TV. But there wasn't something like this that takes you, the audience, on a 90-minute deployment. And we wanted to flesh out the emotional terrain of combat. You know, we all logically understand it, but you don't understand war until you start to get an idea of the emotional shifts that happen. And the emotional shifts aren't just in the kind of fighting. They're also in the downtime as well. And we wanted to kind of bring that to you. And what was interesting about making a documentary is often documentaries sometimes become a little bit like a medicine that you have to take when you're a kid. You know, you know it's good for you, but you don't like the taste of it. But with our film, Restrepo, we wanted to take the illusion that makes kind of the big narrative films, Hollywood films, successful, which is the illusion that you're there. Like, you're watching a Hollywood film. What they do so well is put you in that location. You're inside the bank whilst it's being robbed, or you're in the car during the car chase. Well, here we take you and we put you into this world, you know, and we don't suddenly pull you out to talk to politicians or generals where you suddenly realize that, oh, I'm not in Afghanistan. I'm listening to a documentary about it. So it's really unique because of that very immersive nature.
Right. You stay in it the whole time. And I think you get at some of the deeper emotions. And again, some of the things that we can't understand watching this through the media or reading about it through the media. I want to play another clip now about a young man who was one of the platoon members talking about the way he had to guard his own emotions.
To my family, I never really told him much until about halfway into the deployment. I didn't tell him when Mota died. I didn't tell him when Summer Padilla lost his arm. I didn't tell him when Pisa got shot. I didn't tell him when Restrepo got killed. And then when Restrepo got killed was a few days before my mom's birthday also. So I had to suck it up when I called my mom on her birthday and act like everything was okay and say, hey, Mom, happy birthday. And I'm like, yeah, I'm doing really good out here. Everything's fine.
So there they are, obviously guarding their emotions against even their own family. How did you win their confidence enough to get this kind of footage?
Well, as you know, there's a prickly relationship between the press and the military, and that's a good thing. When the press isn't interrogating the military, then there are problems. And so when we first turned up, obviously the guys were very suspicious of us. They were like, you know, who are these people? And they kept their distance, and it was no sir, yes sir. But over time, you know, we were there over time, and we lived as they lived, and we went on to in every combat operation, every patrol. Obviously, we didn't carry weapons or we didn't pull guns. Guard duty, although occasionally they try and wake me up in the night to see if I'd do that. But we just became part of the platoon. I think they also took most of their casualties in the first 5 months of the deployment. And, you know, at one point early on in deployment, they're running a casualty rate of 25%. They lost their first guy on the first day, walking out to one of the first patrol they did, you know. And so they were focused very much on just living and surviving that experience. And we kind of somehow just became part of the fabric of the platoon. And they used to, when we did leave, we'd come back and they used to look forward to seeing us. We'd bring them news and whatever else. And so, you know, they also saw that we were willing to go to every extreme. And we really went to the edge with them. And they saw that we were going to do that and come back.
You
and,
yourself suffered a minor casualty.
Yeah, I broke my fibula, but coming down a mountain during the middle of the night when we were on a combat operation, people had been killed the days before, and I was on the side of a mountain at night with a broken fibula, and you know, realized the only way to get down was to walk down the mountain carried my pack down there, and later on there was a ceasefire called. I got out and was operated on at Bagram, at the hospital there. And came back once I could get walking again. Came back, and when they saw me come back, they realized. I mean, for me, things had really changed then. They saw that I was part of the platoon, so to speak.
One of the things that struck me about in this film was the sense of mission. What these guys thought they were doing going into this film. I want to play a clip now from Captain Dan Kearney, who we may have heard a little bit earlier, talking about. His understanding of what it was he was going to have to do when he was sent to this valley.
When they told me I was going to the Korngal Valley, I really didn't read anything up on it. I didn't want to. I wanted to go in there with an open mind. The colonel told me initially they take fire every single day. I was like, God, how the hell do you take fire every single day from somebody? You got to go out there and go kill the damn enemy. Quit being scared. Go out there and get them. And the colonel and I came up with what we thought was going to be our campaign plan, and that after 2 months of being there, I would fix it and that we wouldn't get shot at anymore.
Do you think American troops really understand what they're up against in Afghanistan and what the mission is?
American troops are really doing a job just akin to how what the police are doing or the firefighters are doing. I mean, albeit in very different circumstances. But, policemen don't go off on the beat and kind of work out the wider implications of the wider politics of policing. You know, firemen go and put out fires. They're not thinking about, like, you know, is the city council kind of, you know, addressing this problem, or what do we do? Or, you know, so soldiers really see their work. I mean, and we were the grunts. We weren't with the kind of the higher up high officers who are debating strategy and policy in that way. And they look at their job in a very kind of narrow way, because that's how they get through it. And I guess if they started also questioning too much in a deeper way what's going on, they might lose their focus. So they really, even with dealing with the really emotional turmoil that they're in, they put it to the back of their minds almost. And that's why now we're seeing, you know, the ideas of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. These young men, most of them 18 to 22, are dealing with some of the biggest existential questions of their lives, things that we as adults start to deal with as we get older. We're 40, 50, 60. We start to confront death. Friends around us die. We start to think about the big things in life. But here are these young men, 18 years old, you know, dealing with killing people and dealing with their best friend dying in their arms. And so the pressures they're under are quite immense. And I have to say that I had a great deal of respect for them. Mm.
When you see particularly what those soldiers are going through, all of that's very clear. And then Captain Kearney does have, in a sense, a political role, because he has to meet with councils of the people who live in the villages try to explain things and try to win hearts and minds. And there, it seemed, there was a pretty big cultural divide and a pretty big challenge for somebody like Dan Kearney.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, there is a big challenge at the moment, and the idea of winning hearts and minds in a foreign place like Afghanistan is obviously much debated. You know, can the military successfully carry out a counterinsurgency strategy? Is that the military's role to be doing this? Those are all very big issues. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Dan Kearney was 26 years old with 150 men, and the first priority for him was to get all those men back home. And he himself said he failed. Secondly, is that he wanted to bring security to the valley. And, you know, but there was one company, and I think we have to bear in mind that, you know, the Afghan war was terribly mishandled at the beginning. The insurgency started really about 2005. But in 2001, you know, we essentially won in Afghanistan. We went in there and you know, there was peace. And there was over 95% approval rating from Afghans about what had happened. And yet we left. In 2003, we turned and we went to Iraq. And we left 19,000 soldiers there. I mean, there's 40,000 cops in New York City. What were we saying to the Afghan people? We were basically saying, we're not serious about your security. And the Taliban came back in from their havens in Pakistan in 2005. The insurgency started up. And then we underfunded the war because the resources and manpower went to Iraq. And that's a war that I didn't agree with. I don't agree what happened there. But now we're in a situation where, you know, since 2001, 30,000 innocent civilians have lost their lives in Afghanistan. That's a terrible figure, 30,000 innocent people. Interestingly enough, three-quarters of whom are being killed by the insurgents, but still a figure that is not acceptable. But that's nothing compared to the 400,000 that died a decade earlier in the 1990s, you know, when the warlords and the Taliban fought it out. And nothing before the decade previously, when between figures are hard to estimate here, but between a million and a half under the Soviets. So in some very strange way, Afghanistan is at its least level of violence since 79. And we all know that if we pull the plug now and pull our troops out, I mean, Afghans are begging, don't leave now, or privately saying at least, don't leave Afghanistan now, because they're so worried that that those casualty figures will go back to the 1990s. So we are in a real dilemma. What do we do? One thing for certain is we can't win this war without a solid Afghan government. How can Afghans invest themselves in a military to protect their security when they don't know what they're fighting for, especially if the government isn't transparent and has been the level of corruptions that we've been hearing about?
But as you suggest, the contradictions are steep because the military, I mean, is our military there a help or a hindrance to developing those things? When you watch people try to negotiate with villagers coming in after innocent civilians have been killed, to protect American soldiers, Dan had to make some pretty difficult apologies, and he had a tough argument to make to those village elders who were looking around at the bodies of people who had just been killed by Americans. That's a tough argument.
No, you're absolutely right. I think that when you kill people, innocent civilians, then you're going to have a trouble making a comeback argument. And, you know, it's one of the questions. I mean, we'll be talking about this tonight at the Keenan Institute for Ethics at Duke University, because this is a very complicated territory. And, you know, but at the end of the day, it's like we know what we do know is if we start to pull out now, that the civilian toll may go up as a kind of civil war engulfs the country again. And surely we have some responsibility to Afghanistan. We've already left them since we backed the Mujahideen in the 90s, and then we pulled out and walked away. Are we going to do it again? You know, that's the question. And, you know, nobody wants to be in Afghanistan. Everybody understands that only Afghans can bring their own sense of democracy and their own values to their society. But we're in this very difficult situation now and facing, in terms of Afghanistan and Pakistan, probably the most difficult foreign policy problem that's ever been faced by this country. And it's something that we need to discuss and debate on a wider scale, and we hope that our film brings a keyhole through which to see some of the texture of that war that can lead to a kind of more constructive discussion.
I think it does. I think the film does definitely engender a very serious and nuanced discussion about a difficult war and difficult decisions to make. I want to thank you so much, Tim, for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me on.
Tim Hetherington is co-producer and co-director of the documentary film about the war in Afghanistan. It's called Restrepo. Movie's being shown tonight at 7 o'clock, Griffith Theater, Bryan Center, Duke University. It's part of the 2011 Ethics Film Series presented by the Kenan Institute for Ethics. Tim's going to take part in a discussion after the film. For more information, you can go to kenan.ethics.duke.edu. Just ahead, Emo Phillips joins us. Stay tuned.